How were you received by your family and your community?
Happily. They were pleased as hell that I had made it through. And, you know, I want to say again, it's not me, but there was a general attitude, quite general, that that war was an important war. It was a war which was, if we won 100%, we were 99% unified as a nation. There was a lot of appreciation for service. I'll tell you a doggone story to make the point of that. After I worked with him, Don Adams, to keep him here in New York, there were in New York, even during the war, theaters called Brooklyn Paramount, the Bronx, Lowe's Paradise, and others, very large Art Deco movie houses, which to bring in customers on the weekend would have amateur hours. You could come looking to like all this American Idol crap and all that mess. And I said to Don, you know, let's make a few bucks. I want you to enter these things and I'll make the arrangements and so on. We couldn't lose. He was a wonderful, natural comedian, and for this purpose, he was a mimic. He would give you imitations of, you name them, Edward G. Robinson, Jimmy Cagney, President Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and all these, he would do imitations. We used to have our group used to have competitions among ourselves. We called it the Imitation Olympics. We had quite a crowd. Don Yami, a performer, you grandparents will know, Larry Storch, who was in the star of a film, a television series called F Troop, about the Civil War. He survives, he's in his 90s now. But Larry and Don, I say myself, not because I was anywhere in their class, but I was in there in that competition. Larry was the best imitator. He did the best. In any event, we went to the Brooklyn Paramount. We went there, and he couldn't lose. Why? Not because he wasn't a good mimic. He had on his uniform with all the ribbons, and he was greeted as a returning hero, a Marine hero from Guadalcanal, fighting for $25, but that was the first prize. $25, you got that. And that was the beginning of his show business career. And I was his manager. And the only reason I tell this story is because I got $3, I think, for my services, is because the respect that the public had generally for anybody, if it's a Marine, he's fought in Guadalcanal and come home with malaria, was a pretty special person, whereas the poor guys who fought in Vietnam were not always respectfully greeted back here. Sometimes the attitude was, you took part in that war. Wrong attitude, of course, but I've often said on the philosophic side how lucky my generation was that we were able to serve where there was no national debate about it. It was all for one, you know, and you just did it because that's what you did.
So, what was your experience readjusting to civilian life?
Easy.
Easy.
I had a good transition. The occupation, I wasn't being shot at, and I wasn't shooting. And I was doing some very interesting things, working with the Russians on certain things, and diplomatic stuff. Met a lot of interesting people. I really feel that that transition, that year, 14 months before the end of the war until I came home, was a simmering down of everything. And getting back was, again, I hadn't seen enough combat to be made crazy. And also it was just I saw enough to know what it means to be fired at and to be killed. But I found the transition easy. I ended up going back to City College. This lovely lady named Gloria, who had been married 65 years to me in January. I met her on the first day I was back in college. First day I took off my uniform and put on civilian clothes. City College, which is a great institution, put this wearing a suit. Unheard of. You know, you wore jeans or they had them then. And a leather jacket. I had gone to a shop in New York somewhere called Lick Chinnitz and purchased not only a suit to go back to school with, but a gray pinstripe suit. I mean, Wall Street come to City College. And it was the very first day of returning to college. I guess I was home maybe 2 weeks at the time, 3 weeks at the time. There was a gal in that class, a freshman, the early part of the women invading City College. And she tells the story better than I think I've tuned it up pretty high. But she was cute as a button. And she was seated next to a basketball player friend of mine named Sonny Jameson, who became a principal in the New York school system. Great guy. Over to him. I was sort of sitting in the center, the only one in the whole class with a suit on and a pinstripe suit. First day of the class. And she says to Sonny Jameson, not pointing at me, "Who is that?" She said, "What is that?" Luckily, we that very day, not planned, we ended up in the history library studying something. Shall I say it very romantically, the rest is history. We started dating, married in 49, about 3 years later. So I relate the first day back from all that service to meeting a very special guy in my life. And I credit City College for that.
Did you take advantage of the GI Bill?
Absolutely. I didn't have to take advantage of it for City College. It was a free college, so I didn't. All I got was not the tuition, all that stuff. I did get, I think it was $120 a month of compensation. It was like 90 bucks if you were just an ordinary janitor. It was 120 or 110, I think it was, if you had been moved, if you were in any. However, I'm disabled, we got a little more. One was called Public Law 346. That was the general GI Bill. And it was Public Law 16, which was for people who didn't need it anymore. So I did get some monthly money, but the government didn't have to pay for my education. When I went off to Columbia Law School, I took advantage of the GI Bill and my law school, and I have integrated my work with the School of International Affairs at Columbia. I took both faculties in order to get 2 degrees in 4 years instead of 5. You could squeeze it into 4 years, and the GI Bill helped me do all that. It was really a question because, you know, they didn't have, that's not inexpensive law school in the School of International Affairs at Columbia, and I had to appear in some hearings. They wanted to make sure that I was really going to study and so forth and so on, but they let it go through. So I did take care of it. I did take advantage, and I must tell you, I think I wave a flag very quickly and very strenuously. I think the GI Bill of Rights, one of the great pieces of legislation that our country has ever had. It has turned out, if you look at the leadership, good leadership, bad, but people who assumed positions of leadership through the years, who took advantage of education they might not have gotten without the GI Bill. I think it's paid off a millionfold. And I'm happy that there's been some more recognition of that for the current veterans who are suffering so much more than we did. I mean, if I had to worry about IEDs, you know, those outside bombs that you don't know when it's going to hit you and cripple you and make you crazy. Ours was a walk in the, what do they used to call it, a walk in the country. It was so much easier. Tough, but easier than what these guys go through. Easier than what the Vietnam veterans who were not appreciated. You know, especially ours was a, I don't believe we were the, quote, greatest generation, as Mr. What's the name, the CBS commentator?
Brokaw. Tom Brokaw.
Tom Brokaw. I've said that, that's not true. I don't think any generation, but what I do think, the generation before us, which are were thousands upon thousands of immigrants who came to make a new life for themselves and started from scratch and built the railroads and the big, anyway, I think that generation had more tough stuff than our generation. We had a nation behind us. We had the GI Bill waiting for us. I think it's nice to be called the greatest generation, but it's not a bad generation.
And what have you done for a living afterwards?
Sat here and given an interview. Well, I've had... this gets personal, but you asked the question. I was lucky to have the service in the military that I did. I've also been lucky in the choices I've made and what I've done with my professional life. I have had a diverse, starting with practicing law in a very eminent New York law firm, and then getting into the legal department of what my interest was entertainment law, communications law, copyright, showbiz. That was my original interest. And I joined a corporation called Young and Rubicam, which was an eminent, probably the basis for Mad Men. I mean, it was an ad agency, and I was assistant general counsel. Doing television contracts, doing what I loved. Then I went off to Washington, the General Counsel of the United States Information Agency, and of all the jobs I've had, that's my favorite, because it combined, you know, I mentioned that I got those both degrees when I was a senior in the fourth year of that program and back at the law school, and I was offered a job in the legal advisor's office of the State Department, which sort of fit what I was doing, law, international law, and international affairs, and foreign language, and so forth. And it's a very personal story because Eisenhower had been the president at Columbia, and Eisenhower had become president. And here I was of the United States, and I was being asked to join the State Department, the legal advisor's office, which was pretty heavy. But I realized that Eisenhower, this is more about me than anything, Eisenhower had selected as his Secretary of State a man named John Foster Dulles, who had views on foreign policy with which I fundamentally disagreed. And I said to myself, my God, if I'm there and they're asking me for a legal opinion to justify what this guy believes in, I can't do that. And I realized that I couldn't be a professional or a civil service person or, you know, or even foreign services because I'm too political. Because if I don't agree, oh, it's a modest disagreement, that doesn't matter. But there's some fundamental disagreements about nuclear policy or something, and I'm supposed to defend something that I would have a hard time. But, by good fortune, I turned that down when I was invited by the Kennedy administration by a man named Edward R. Murrow. If you don't know his name, you should, because you didn't his kind of work. Name. Edward R. Murrow is one of my heroes, and he was good enough to ask me to join him after Kennedy asked him to be the director of USIA. And it combined on the statute books. I was in charge of the legal work, so I had a legal staff. I was in charge of the congressional liaison work, because the job is called general counsel and congressional liaison. And being in charge of the congressional liaison gave me the political stuff that I love, working with the chairman of the various committees and so forth. And thirdly, it gave me a chance to use such specialization I have in international affairs and a lot of international negotiation. 6 weeks in Bangkok, Thailand, negotiating a treaty involving communication between the U.S. and southern China, Voice of America operation. Long story, I will not go into it, but about the things I've done, that job combined all the things I loved, being General Counsel of USIA. And I had a wonderful legal staff, and it's just a great, great job. And it allowed me to work the Hill. And Ed Morrow, who is, for me, all good things, he liked to say, "Stanley, I hate Mahomet. You love him. So I want you to be our liaison to the White House." And I worked with Larry O'Brien, who was the congressional man at the White House, and Kennedy O'Donnell, and Ted Sorensen. And I got a chance to, I wasn't part of the inner circle by any means, but I had a chance to work with these guys around Kennedy. It was a wonderful experience. So that's the answer to your question about what I've done after. Now, I came back from Washington, formed a law firm, and built it from, we wanted to get to 20 lawyers, and we got to about 120 over time, which was not our ambition, but it just turned out that we built the law practice, and then merged it into another firm, Hugh, which has now come out of another firm, which is huge. So I'm part of a firm I had no sense of ownership, but they allow me to continue. It has 2,400 lawyers. It has 45 offices, and they do fabulous work. But it's not for me. It's just that I'm too far along to now start something. So I've gone along for the ride. And I enjoy the people. They do fine work and a lot of beautiful pro bono work. With my partner, when we formed our firm in 1966, our ambition was to make enough money so that we secure college educations for our children and then spend all of our time doing pro bono work, just earn enough to live on, but do what we would think was good works for people in need and places, companies with special needs and so forth. We never could fulfill that because we started to grow. Frankly, there was an influx of terrific lawyers who were not as interested in pro bono work as my partner Howard Squadron and I were. So we never got to do. He was very active in important community affairs, and I became very active in the performing arts community in New York, volunteering as this and that, become chairman of the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. If you don't know him, you ought to get to know him. They're fabulous, and I'm chairman emeritus. I had 16 years as chairman. I still do stuff for them, and they've given me a big, happy part of my life. And I represented the Bob Joffrey Ballet Company. They're all pro bono in New York's performing arts field. And do I have to be a lawyer to do that? Probably not, but being a lawyer didn't hurt. It was a contract problem, I could handle it, and so forth. So I've had, and I think I'm allowed, although it's arrogant, at 87, I'm allowed to say I'm a very lucky person. I managed to do, before, during, and after the war, things that I either loved going in or loved as I came out.
Are you, or have you been involved in any veterans organizations?
Not many. I was reluctant to join the American Legion, and reluctant to join the American Veterans Committee, which was very liberal early after the war. I'm not sure they still exist. I don't know. I have a view that being a veteran is not a big deal. That is to say, we all serve and to put on a cap and to do these things. And I know it sounds awful for me to say it. You know, it wasn't necessary. We all serve. through the years, I guess what got me more interested in it was my own division. And I started attending, after a long period of time, every few years a division reunion, seeing the old guys and so forth. So that when here in this community, when a wonderful guy named Anthony Marsala, I met him because I'd been asked by a teacher at Hummings to participate in a little class that he had every year, a class on the Second World War. And I would with Tony and with Richard and another gentleman was there, I'm forgetting. And Tony kept saying, "So Stanley, why aren't you with the VFW?" And I said, we're all veterans. Why are you? But I joined. And I've been very happy to join the VFW. It's a reducing number of World War II people, but we have a few post. There are more, some Korea, mostly Vietnam. And we're not getting Iraq, Afghanistan yet. I hope that won't happen. And they do such good work in this community. I couldn't have chosen a better post, but I realized what a wonderful deal had been made with the town to combine the physical facility for the senior citizens, as well as remaining space for the VFW post to operate. And the money that we have, somebody left some money in his will, and we have a sale leaseback arrangement that I don't know the details of, but we worked out so that we have money to keep this thing going. And over it to make our own post contributions. This year, I'm proud to say that this is the second or third year in a row we've given away $30,000 plus to other vendors' organizations. This one where they use canine something something to do wonderful work, training dogs to be available to wounded veterans. Fabulous operation. There's somewhere here in Westchester. And there are many others, well-known other veterans to which we contribute. And we have a small scholarship at Manhattan High School, which I had suggested we do, and that was picked up. Won't get you through college. It might cover your transportation for a few weeks. It's a very nominal, but it's a recognition. And for Rhinet as well. So, I have not been an active veterans organization purpose, although I've read literature through the years. I've been on various lists. I'd once thought of joining it's a Purple Heart organization. It's just Purple Heart veterans. But as I say, I always felt that made you try to be different, but you weren't different. They were all the same, so why do that? I feel somewhat different now, but I'm very happy to have joined the I'm very happy that Kemper is being defended the way it has been. The notion of changing or shifting it is crazy. A little recognition for what people did for this community. So I'm happy with the work that Richard has done. I think actually Tony Marsala has been helpful on that, as has Bert Corwin as the head of the post. So they're good people. I must say our meetings are so small in numbers now, it's a shame, but the fact that we vote on where we're going to send our money is a nice thing that you can recommend. We have a little committee that checks out the bona fides of the organization that has requested some money.
And last question. How would you reflect on how your war experiences have affected your life? What kinds of life lessons do you think you've gotten out of your service?
I'm going to tell you maybe the last question, but it's the most difficult because I don't know. What is it that wartime service, that combat service does? You come to it with what you had before that. So what I had until I was 18 years old, I'm sure had some impact on me then. His father who loved to teach me how to do close order drill when I was a kid. It almost feels that there was a fit the good fortune was that I survived. But the idea that I went into the service within a month of my 18th birthday, that I tried to go in the service 2 years before, coupled with the good luck that I had in surviving, how has that impacted my life? It's given me a lot of stories to tell, which I didn't tell for 50 years. I mean, I didn't even tell my children. But when I once started, I said to my son something like, he said, it was Vietnam, the time of Vietnam. He said, Dad, did you kill anybody? I said, yes. And I just shook him up terribly when I said that. So it was nothing that was talked about. We talk about more now because I've gotten older. I like the stories myself. I like to hear them again. And I like to think about Benny Foster. I like to think about Rufus Clapham and Vino Red. So, did I respond to your last question, which I admit is a valid question? How has it affected my life? A, I'm sure it has. B, I'm not sure how it has. I mean, you come to the event with a lot of stuff that's been there from early. Maybe my experiences in the war reflected what I had in me, if you will, before. I regret none of it. I'm a softie on that. I don't spend time thinking about what might have been and so forth. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to love just about everything I've done. And I'm certain that it's had an effect, but how it fits in, I don't know. If I can have had a minute's impact on that German law student and the Peace Corps, and that's done any good, I'm very happy that I was able to have something to do with winning that war. That's happy. Give me an answer, man. I'd love to have an answer. You have a theory on how wartime, I mean, if, after all, if I'd been mortally wounded and couldn't get around, that one would say, well, I've had to stay in hospitals for years, and that's changed my life. I didn't have any of that. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks in the hospital, you know, blessed by a young woman who was a member of the voluntary organization, the French, La Rouge Française, the French Red Cross, who lived in the town of Epinal, where the hospital was, and who was really a bad volunteer, because she would come to my room. I was an officer, so I had my own room. She'd forget that she's supposed to visit all the wounded Americans, you know. We'd spend our time, she'd teaching me French, and I came to know the family one by one. There's so many stories about that, but to this day, they're dying. I have such a feeling of connection to a certain family in Epinal, France. Anybody tells me, the French are this, the frogs are that, they won't get that from me. I have found them to be, are they wise guys? Absolutely. Are we sometimes wise guys? Sure. But the love that this family gave to me in the hospital, keeping up with me, and you know, was just terrific. So I could keep going on because there were lots of experiences. They would all be of the same sort. Learning, appreciating what I was learning, trying to do a little good, knowing that a lot of good sometimes is impossible, but you do a little good. And you should work on how should the war impact? That is a topic for your masters of arts and military history. And how should a war impact on a soldier? I'm not quite the flag waver my father was, but it's somewhere in that ballpark.
Do you speak Russian?
I don't speak Russian, although my work in School of International Affairs at Columbia, you have to take, when you're doing the international, you have to take an area of the world, and whatever area you take, you have to get one. I took the Soviet Union in 1950. I graduated college in 48, so between 48 and 52 was my... And I took the Soviet Union and I studied Russian for 2 years. And whenever I get a chance, I try to, but it, you know, unless you're speaking it constantly. It was not spoken in my home.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. No, so your parents did not speak Russian to each other?
No. There was a time when my mother came here at age 2. My father came here at 16, so he spoke, he was able to speak Russian more fluently. My mother went to class to learn Russian. Why? So they could talk in a way that I wouldn't understand. When they had things to say, right, they didn't want their son Stanley to know about. But it was not taught, it was not spoken. I speak pretty good French. That's a some measure, just those lessons in that French located hospital. But whenever I get a chance, I speak. And I had a lot of it in school. My major was at one point back in high school. I thought I would be a language major. I could teach in the high school just with my uncle and aunt. Spanish, not bad. German, very elementary. Kind of wartime German. I'll brag, okay. I'm not allowed to have one brag or 10. When I was in Thailand, negotiating a very important treaty for our country, which was very unusual, I was general counsel, USA. I was not in the State Department. Usually, the State Department takes care of international negotiations. Of course, it was communications, the work that our agency does. They said Stanley should do it, and so I was in charge of the delegation that was negotiating with the Thai government. And every morning, 6 or 6.30, a woman came to my room. We had breakfast, and she gave me a Thai language lesson. I love languages. The negotiations day to day were conducted in English. The Thais were represented by their foreign minister, whose name was Thanak Koman, and his young administrative assistant with 5 different law degrees named Somphong Sucharipun. The negotiations were in English. Their English was superb. They were better. There came a day when I was getting tired, my family, I'd been away 6 weeks at that point, maybe 5. And I had learned before I went over, I was taught by some of the State Department, you have to be very patient in negotiating with people from the Far East, Southeast Asia, and stuff. And you should go around and around and around until you get to where you want to go. I was used to negotiating with a phone call or two, you know, getting a deal done. And I said to my tutor, I said, can you teach me the word in Thai for compromise? That's a very philosophical concept. I tried to explain to her about that. She finally came up with the word pranom. The English line of the American conversation would be P-R-A-N-O-M, pranom. And when I entered the negotiating room at the foreign ministry that day, I said, in an effort to speak good Thai, first time, I said, good morning, I hope you're well. Today I would like us to reach a compromise. And I said it all in Thai. And Thanak Koman, and almost at the same time, both of them said, perfect Thai. They gave me the answer. They said, okay. Okay. Want to compromise? Okay. They said, okay, that's what you say in Thai, and that's what you say in English. So I've, whenever I, you know, had anything to do with talking about careers in the Foreign Service and so forth, it's always been my view. I think it's generally accepted now. It's pretty good to be able to talk the language of the people within your negotiation, people within your And the French are very much like that. The French hate it if you don't know their language. There is an arrogance in that. On the other hand, if you speak some French, my God, you're where did you learn your French? How did you learn? You must have a French family, and so forth and so on. So it comes in handy. You like foreign languages?
I've been taking French for good. High school.
That's a good start. Good start. I still love it.
Have you seen the World War II exhibit in the New York Historical Society about New York City and World War II?
I did. I did see that with friends who live in Scarsdale. A friend in Scarsdale who's about 7 or 8 years younger than I am, who is a buff about World War II. And he's ever climbing me with questions about World War II. Whenever he sees something on television, he goes to stand up and see it. And his favorite picture of himself is when he's about 9 years old and he's dressed in a military thing, you know. To know that if he was old enough, he would have served. And he's a terrific guy. And why do I mention that? It has to do with what was the sentence before I started?
The exhibit at the New York Historical Society.
He took us to that. He had seen it, and he said, "Come on, oh, maybe you read about it." And we went together. That was a lot of fun. A lot of familiar stuff about the city of New York.
Right, it was very interesting.
Yeah.
But one thing that surprised me were there were actually, not on the west side, on the east side in the 80s, in Yorktown, Nazi rallies in the 30s.
Yorktown Heights, 86th Street to 96th Street, 75th, on the east side, not Yorktown Heights, what was it? Yorkville,
I said Yorktown, yeah, Yorkville.
That was a festering place for German Brauhauses. You know that word Brauhaus? It's a beer hall. My friend Don in the Army was just starting to become popular. And in Jackson Heights, Queens, I was running for a local political office, not for a public spot, but for a spot in the party organization. We were a reform movement trying to kick them, we thought, ineffective old timers out, and there was a rally in a German type Brauhaus in Jackson Heights, Queens, for me and my campaign. And I invited him, and I said, "I've only got to say a few words, tell him a few jokes, warm up the crowd." And this would be in 1959, so he's already hasn't started. I think. Gets March shows started by 1962, I think, something like that. What he was doing, well, he was doing a lot of stand-up comedy all over the place. And he was on late-night shows all the time. Anyway, he gets up to speak. The German Brauhaus, you may remember, is where Adolf Hitler started. And he looks around and he says, "My friend Stanley, we grew up together, starting a political career. But in a spot like this, is that what Stanley has become?" The place was in hysterics that I was starting my career in a German Brauhaus, you know, like Adolf Hitler. Always with a good line. Listen, thank you for your patience. I know that this went much longer than you anticipated.
No, it's fine.
And you understand that I'm taking the liberty of being 87, I can't stop that. Take the liberty of thinking of things and expanding on more than what it is.
Oh, it's invaluable.
I thank you for your patience.
Thank you so much.
All right.